Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
Good evening. Welcome into the Toasted Tavern, Wags and Scott alongside you for a big day in sports. And yes, it's a Monday and we're talking about big news. But first off, Scott, how was your Thanksgiving? A beautiful weekend, some interesting football games to say the least, and a lot of sports action. But did you get enough to eat on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, it was a good weekend. It was a weird Thanksgiving. My family had stuff going on. We actually didn't do our Thanksgivings. We had one on Friday night and one on Sunday. So kind of spread out and everybody was doing stuff. We didn't do our one family on Thursday because my stepbrother and sister-in-law went down to Dallas on Thursday for the Cowboys-Raiders game. So they were down there. So we did Thanksgiving Friday night. And then my mom's family did Thanksgiving on Sunday. But yeah, it was good. And I called a bunch of college basketball in between, or high school basketball in between all of that. So yeah, good weekend. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. Had everybody over on Thursday. Had a lot of good food. Got a chance to watch those football games. It didn't go quite like I thought they were going to go, but nonetheless, they were decently good games. And then the rest of the weekend was just kind of watching everything kind of play out with regards to Major League Baseball and in the college football landscape. And, you know, we are going to come on tonight and talk all about Major League Baseball's free agent signings and the frenzy that's going on there. But you know, the college football scene has to swoop in and get their stuff in there as well to try and taint MLB's day. And we'll talk a little bit about the college football stuff later, but just in the last 30 minutes, breaking news that Brian Kelly is heading to LSU, being lured away from Notre Dame on a 10-year, $100 million-plus contract. We'll talk about that in a little bit because he's not the only college football coach that was moving this weekend, and there's going to be more to follow for sure. But that just broke here in the last 30 minutes, so we're going to have to dissect that as we go. But really, you have to get into Major League Baseball today because it was absolutely crazy. Money flying all over the place. And for a league that's getting ready to potentially shut down with contract negotiations between the players and the union, the players' union and you know, Major League Baseball, all around money, the amount of money that has been thrown around really the last 24 hours just makes you sit back and scratch your head. And you know, the Cardinals weren't necessarily totally involved in that. I think they actually made a very, very smart signing, something we talked about last week in a sense with Steven Matz coming in 4 years, $44 million. But you have to look at everything else that went down today and go, where do the Cardinals fit in some of these other pieces? And will they be able to make moves? Because Mo said last week and really even the last couple days that there was a lot of stuff in the works, but are we on the verge of the Cardinals having a hand in everything, but just like guys like David Price, not actually completing the deals?
Well, you know, Mo said today during the Steven Matz press conference that the Cardinals had contract offers out there and more than one contract offer out there right now to guys, you know, and we'll just have to wait and see, you know, if guys are willing to take them. I honestly don't know. You look at what happened and you talk about some of the guys that signed in the last few days. You know, I don't think anybody expected. I think we all expected free agency to be some crazy 48-hour period in the first part of February after the lockout ended. I don't think anybody expected this to happen before the lockout. But I mean, you look at the market right now. It, pretty much all the starting pitching is gone. You know, the big names have all pretty much signed at this point, which, you know, I don't think anybody expected. And, you know, it kind of started with Steven Matz and the Cardinals last week with his, like you said, you know, 4 year, $44 million contract with, which we, when you look at what everybody else has gotten in the last couple of days is really, really nice. But, you know, I don't think anybody expected Max Scherzer to sign before the deadline on Wednesday. And for the Mets to give him 3 years and what is it? 3 years and $130 million. I mean,
yeah,
that's just absolutely asinine. As much as I love Max Scherzer, and you know the guy's a warrior and everything you want to say about the guy's 37 years old and he's coming off having to miss a playoff start because of dead arm, and you're going to give him his 38, 39, and 48 years seasons, he's going to make $43 million a year, which breaks any record ever by almost $8 million more than anybody's ever made in a season before that. I mean, I think I read that he's going to make like $250,000 for every inning pitched this year, something like that. That's insane. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. You know that, and you look around and you talk about teams and why teams are bad. What the Texas Rangers did today and yesterday is gonna set that team back so many years. Because yeah, Marcus Semien's good, but you signed a guy who's going to be 32 to a $7 million deal, and then you go out and sign a shortstop who, yeah, everybody talked about him. You know, in Corey Seager, you know, he's a stud, but he's 27. Everybody's already talking about the fact that he can't play shortstop for another year or two because his defense has eroded that much, and you give him a $10 million deal. You just signed two middle infielders for $500 million. I mean, that makes no sense. And then you throw on – I mean, it really doesn't. And then you throw in John Gray on top of that, who's going to make, you know, $65 million and has injury problems. And from everything everybody's talking, they're going to go bring in Clayton Kershaw in the next couple of days too, which we know that Clayton, you know, you're paying for the name Clayton Kershaw more than anything else at this point. So, you know, I don't see that being – while it gets you a lot of headlines, I'm not sure that the Rangers are going to be a whole lot better. And the same thing with the Mets. You look what the Mets did. You know, yeah, you went and got Starling Marte, but he's 32 and you gave him a 6-year deal. You went and signed a third baseman who was okay. He had a breakout year, but you gave him 5 years and a bunch of money. You signed an outfielder from the A's who's an okay player, but you gave him a bunch of money. And then what you did with Max, you know, you got to look at the fact that, yeah, you got Max Scherzer, but you've also lost Marcus Stroman and, you know, potentially Noah Syndergaard if he's healthy. So there's two huge pieces of your bullpen, of your rotation. So with all the money that they spent, did the Mets really get any better? I'm not sure that they did, honestly.
Well, they spent $250 million on those guys in Marte, Eduardo Escobar, Mark Canha, and Max Scherzer. And like you said, it's hard to tell, you know, if that makes them any better at all. Yes, they probably got the two of the three best starters in the National League in DeGrom and Scherzer, but you talked about the dead arm that Scherzer experienced last year at the end of the year, missing the playoff start. You know, he's going to be in his late 30s, into his 40s when this contract's over. I mean, it's a great deal to sign if you're Max Scherzer, but if you're the Mets, was Steve Cohen just that pissed off about the Cardinals going to 4 years with Mats that he's just like, fuck it, I'm just going to spend a crap ton of money on guys just to bring in names so people can't say I didn't spend the money to try and improve this team? Because, you know, if you listen to what Cohen said after, you know, Mats signed with the Cardinals, like, he was legit pissed off that, you know, he didn't get a chance to re-sign with the Mets. You know, he was brought up by the Mets, went to the Blue Jays last year, and you know, everything was going towards New York re-signing him, but then the Cardinals went to the fourth year and the Mets didn't. And Cohen was pissed about that. So he was pissed at $44 million over 4 years, yet he goes out and spends $250 million on four guys, one of which may be good for you, the other three, who knows?
Right. You know, and that's what a lot of people said today. Was he that upset? Like you said, was he that upset with Mats that he said, okay, I'm going to throw so much money at Max Scherzer, there's no way he goes to St. Louis. You know, a lot of people have talked about that today. Yeah, it's crazy. It makes no sense at all. And you look at the teams that are spending money, it's not the Yankees. It's not the Red Sox. It's not the Dodgers. It's not the Padres. It's not the Giants. It's the Mariners. It's the Rays. You know, it's the Mets. It's the Rangers. It's not the powerhouse teams. You know, you're hearing nothing from the Dodgers. And look what's happened to the Dodgers in the last week. You've lost Clayton Kershaw and Max Scherzer out of your rotation. You've lost Corey Seager, and it sounds like they have no interest in bringing back Chris Taylor. So those are four huge pieces that the Dodgers are going to lose, and they haven't signed anybody to replace them. You know, is this a sign that the Dodgers are kind of like, okay, we've had our run, now it's kind of time to pull back a little bit, maybe?
It's possible. I mean, I saw a nice doctored picture of Mookie Betts just in the outfield with his arms like this going, where's everybody at? I mean, if you're Mookie Betts, how happy are you about signing that contract extension now knowing that you're going to have zero people around you that are going to make this team better? Now, the Dodgers did go out and looks like they're close to an agreement with Daniel Hudson on a 1-year, $7 million contract. But, you know, that's a bullpen piece. That's not going to do much to help your rotation. But, yeah, I mean, the Dodgers haven't really done a whole lot. And, you know, you talk about Seattle. Now, I'll say this. Robbie Ray going to Seattle. You know, the Mariners were a surprise second-place team in the AL West last year. And I'm not going to sit there and say they're going to be back in that same spot this year. But to bring in a guy like Ray, who is the reigning Cy Young winner in the American League. He led the AL in ERA, innings pitched, strikeouts, whip. He also has one of the best strikeout ratios in the game right now, even better than some of the premier pitchers in this league. And, yeah, 5 years, $115 million. That's a lot of money to go to a guy that, you know, has dealt with injuries in the past. But, I mean, I kind of like deceptively like what Seattle did in that instance, you know, pairing him up there at the top of the rotation. You got a Marco Gonzalez after that. I kind of like what the Mariners are doing in a sense, but they're the one team that, you know, you could sit there and justify this. You know, the Mets going out and doing what they did, the Rangers doing what they did. I mean, it's throwing money on things. You know, they still, yeah, they brought in John Gray in Texas, but really that pitching staff is still terrible. Right. It's not like they're going to win games with pitching. Toronto goes out and gets Kevin Gausman. I mean, I kind of like that move, but you're losing guys, you know, like Steven Matz that you're not going to have there this year. But here's another team that is kind of under the radar as well, and it's in that NL East where you got to look at the Marlins just did. You know, they traded for the Gold Glove caliber or Gold Glove winner in Stallings, catcher. They also re-signed Avisel Garcia and Sandy Alcantara. So they're kind of building a little bit through youth and through some pieces as well. But you know, look at the teams that made money. Like you said, they're the teams, you know, the Rangers won like 60 or 68 games last year, bringing in a oft injured shortstop, a second baseman that had a breakout year. And granted, Marcus Semien's had been great. He's only missed 10 games over the last four seasons. So he's a stalwart. He's not going to miss the games that Seager does, but he's also not as consistent as a guy like Seager is when he's in the lineup. So you've got all that. Is that going to be enough to do anything for Texas? It's a really, I don't know how many more wins they're going to get because they brought those guys in.
No, but it's going to put butts in the seats. You got to remember that they have a brand new stadium that they spent all that money on that opened during a pandemic. So, you know, and Corey Seager is a Texas guy.
Clayton Kershaw crushed the ball in that bubble.
Yeah. So you're bringing in Seager, who's a Texas guy. Clayton Kershaw from Texas, if they bring him there. You know, they're bringing in guys that are going to put people in the seats. So, you know, in that division, you know, is going to be up for grabs because we know that Oakland's kind of tearing things down. You know, they're talking about trading Olsen and Chapman in Oakland. Houston's losing Carlos Correa. You know, how good are they going to be? They're going to start to slide a little bit. So that division's up for grabs. And like you said, I'm going to go back to Seattle a little bit too, because let's not forget the trade Seattle made last week either. They went out and got Adam Frazier too, who, you know, was one of the best hitters in the National League before he moved to San Diego. And, you know, the Padres didn't really do a whole lot. You know, they were moving him all over the place, and he didn't hit as well in San Diego as he did in Pittsburgh. But if you put Frazier there in that lineup, like you said, with Mitch Haniger and those guys that started to show some signs last year, and then, you know, there's a lot of scuttlebutt that Seattle's not done. It sounds like there's a real good chance that Chris Bryant ends up in Seattle. So, you know, Seattle's not done. That's going to be interesting to see if they make a run. So there could be a little bit of a power shift, you know, in the American League West. You know, like I said, you know, I agree with you. I don't know that Texas is going to win a lot because their pitching's still not going to be good. You know, the Angels have gone and done a couple of things, but I still don't see them having enough pitching. You know, they brought in Syndergaard, but I'm not sure that they're going to have enough to be able to really make a run out there. So, you know, it's going to be interesting. You know, like I said, you know, the big names we're not hearing anything about. And then you talk about the National League Central, and, you know, there's crickets there. You know, all you're hearing from the Reds is that they're talking about trading everybody. You know, that Castillo and Sonny Gray are both on the market. You know, that they're looking to move both of those two starters. The Brewers don't appear to be ready to do anything. And the little bit of offense that the Brewers had last year, they're all gone now. You know, Garcia left, Escobar left. You know, they're pretty much left with Christian Yelich and a whole lot of nothing in Milwaukee offensively. The Cubs don't appear to be ready to do anything. And, you know, that leads you to the Cardinals, who, like we said, Mo, you know, said again today that the Cardinals do have multiple offers out there to people, you know, and we'll see if anything happens in the next 36 hours, you know, before the supposed lockout. Although we're still not really sure that a lockout's even gonna happen. You know, you're hearing some rumblings that it will, some rumblings that it may not. So, you know, all this may happen and there may not even be a lockout. So we'll see what happens. I think the Cardinals are going to do something. You know, Ken Rosenthal reported today that the Cardinals were, you know, really trying to shore up their pitching. You know, apparently they've got offers out there to Luis Garcia, and we've heard rumblings that Joe Kelly, you know, that they've had multiple conversations with Joe Kelly. And then, you know, Marcus Stroman, you know, we've heard that Stroman has interest in the Cardinals, that the Cardinals still may have interest in Stroman. You know, I guess the big question with Stroman now is when you look around and see what all these other starting pitchers have gotten in the last few days, where is his asking price? I think if you're Marcus Stroman and you look around, you have to be slotted somewhere underneath what Robbie Ray got, since he just won the American League Cy Young, and you've never done that. Although Kevin Gausman got $115 million, which is a little bit high for him too. So I'm not real sure where Stroman fits in there, because he's younger than a lot of those guys as well. So, you know, his asking price may have just absolutely gone through the roof, you know. And the same thing with the shortstops. You know, you've got three big ones left in Correa, Story, and Baez. And when you know that Carlos Correa is probably going to get $300 million, he's going to be in the same range as Seager. But what does what Marcus Semien just got, you know, the $177 million, what does that do to Trevor Story and Javi Baez asking prices? And again, I know that Semien was an AL MVP candidate, but he's also, you know, 4 years older than those guys. So, you know, where do they go now? Does Trevor Story all of a sudden say, I thought I wanted to sign a 2-year, $50 million deal and try to kind of rebuild my reputation, but hell, I want 5 years and $150 million now. You know, there's just a lot of questions there as to what those markets are going to look like.
Well, if you're talking about a CBA that's getting ready to expire and you're not sure what, you know, the negotiations are going to be that come out of this, if you get a chance to cash in at this point and say, okay, I can get $200 million guaranteed, regardless on what this CBA turns out to be, I'm going to take it. That's what I'm going to ask for. I'm seeing guys get a ton of money. You know, you're not going to bet on yourself at this point. You're going to bet on, you know, what is the most I can get out of a team at this point. And that's the crazy thing, because, you know, we thought going into this offseason that a lot of these players and teams were going to hold off to see what the CBA ends up being. But, you know, now you're sitting there going, okay, who's really got the most leverage here? Because, you know, the players are getting all this money before the CBA is signed. So that's all guaranteed. What are the owners getting out of this? Are the owners thinking that, okay, hey, we're going to sign these guys, but when we do this contract negotiation, we're going to put buyouts into this, like the NHL did when they renegotiated and said, okay, well, hey, maybe after, you know, the first year, we're going to be able to buy out some of these guys, and this contract isn't guaranteed. I mean, I don't think that's going to be the case.
There's no way that'll happen. Yeah, there's no way that'll happen in baseball. If they try to do that, we won't have a season, because the players union is too strong in baseball for that to happen. That's the interesting thing now too, is if you're these players' agents, you know, why are the owners spending all this money right before a thing? It almost makes you think they're like, okay, salaries are going to go through the roof after this new negotiation, because the players have more leverage than we do. So let's try to sign these guys faster. So then are the players' agents going, okay, see what these guys got? When the new negotiations are coming, salaries are going to be even bigger. So don't sign now. Hold out, and we'll get you twice that, you know, in 2 months. So, you know, how are agents looking at it? How are the players looking at it? How are the, you know, it's just, like you said, it's really weird. It makes no sense that everybody's fighting over money and crying poor, and then you can throw this kind of money around. You know, for the owners, remember right after the lockout last year when Bill DeWitt said, you know, baseball's not as profitable as people like to think. Owners don't have the money that people think they do. Well, guess what, Bill? Your cohorts are proving you're wrong right now, and we all know that Bill DeWitt is one of the richest owners in baseball, so that argument doesn't really stand up. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens. Will the rest of tonight and tomorrow be like today was, or will it be even crazier?
I can see it being a lot crazier.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we could see moves going. I mean, moves were going fast and frantic today. I was at work and like had my phone out and was like I was having a hard time working because like my phone kept beeping. I'm like, holy crap, what is going on? It's fun. You know, I mean, this was the hot stove that we wanted to have that we haven't had in a long time, but hopefully it continues, and we'll see. Hopefully the Cardinals can get a couple of things done before before whatever happens on Wednesday.
Yeah, because Wednesday is pretty much the hard deadline because that's when the CBA expires. So stuff's going to have to get done by tomorrow night at midnight for any of it to really take hold, regardless of how the CBA kind of plays out after that. And speaking of the CBA, a couple of pieces of what the talks may include popped out today in regards to the playoffs and the draft. And I'll get to the playoffs here in just a second. Let's talk about the draft real quick. They looking at potentially pitching a draft lottery, something that they do in the NBA as well, where it's basically a system that all non-playoff teams would have a chance at the number one pick. Not just the team with the worst record, so trying to eliminate the tanking piece of it. Now, obviously, the worst team would still have the best odds, and it would drop down from there. The lottery would only be for picks numbers 1 through 3, and then the draft would continue based off of records like in the past season. So it's not, hey, the 16 teams that don't make it, everybody has a chance, and then it goes from there. It's really just the top 3 picks that are really in play for that lottery. I mean, with baseball, it's not like some of these other sports, like the NBA, like the NFL, and even really now so the NHL, where these picks are high impact right off the bat getting into Major League Baseball, at the end of the draft, essentially. I mean, you're starting to see a little bit more of it now, but, is this something that you can sit there and say, okay, it makes sense, but is it really going to make that big of an impact?
I mean, I think it could because, it will decentify some of those things for teams like Pittsburgh and Baltimore. Those teams are like, oh, we'll just lose all year and then we'll get a high draft pick, or we'll trade our high draft pick and do what do the things that they've done. Hopefully it'll stop some of that. There won't be that guarantee automatically that you're going to get that number one pick. They're just trying to come up with ways to try to get some of those teams to actually spend money without actually having a cap or a floor and a cap, and different ways to try to keep teams from just completely tanking and getting them to actually spend money and try to compete. So I don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's a bad idea. I think anything you can do to try to get, like I said, the Pittsburghs, the Baltimores, those teams to really try to be competitive ball clubs is important.
Well, and now you're going to have to think about how playoffs are going to be affected by that as well, because there's a playoff pitch that's going to be going out there with these negotiations as well that are once again – for purists, making you go, why? So this is kind of the breakdown of what the playoff pitch is going to be. So the team with the best record in each league would get a bye into the best of 5 division series. That's number one. Next up, the remaining 2 division winners would get to pick their wild card opponent, with the second best record picking first, and then the number 3 seed in the league would pick its opponents from the final 2 wild card teams. The wild card team with the best record would play the wildcard team that wasn't picked by a division winner. And once matchups are set, the higher-seeded teams would host all 3 games in a best-of-3 wildcard round. And the winners in the wildcard round would advance to the division series, and the playoffs would continue as they have in the past. So something that the idea was kind of floated a little bit last well about potentially teams being able to pick their opponents and things like that. It's getting some traction, on both sides of the aisle in a sense. There are some owners that hate it, some owners that are intrigued by it. Same thing with the players. I mean, it makes a little bit of sense because the intrigue is there about, okay, you want to maybe get the high seed to get the bye, but do you really want to take the time off? If you're a division winner, you get a chance to pick, but is that beneficial or is that a detriment? I mean, there's a lot of pieces that go into it. Does it push for more teams to incentivize themselves to win games, or does it make them go, okay, hey, we can get to 80 and still get in, and then maybe have healthy players at the end of the year and be a low seeded wild card team that goes on a run? I mean, there's a lot of different pieces that go into it, but is it a good framework for the future for the playoffs, or are we just getting to a point where we're adding too many teams?
I don't have a problem with adding the teams. If you have 7 teams, or I think is what they're talking about, 14 total, I don't have a problem with that. And they don't have a problem with the higher seeds having all 3 games at home in those wild card rounds. The thing that I wouldn't want, and that 2 things I don't like. First of all, if I'm one of those teams that wins, I don't want that bye. How many times in baseball, especially in baseball, do you see a team, even if they win a series early and they sit around for 3 or 4 days while another series is playing, and those teams get hot and get on a roll, and you may have been hot, and then all of a sudden you go into a funk, your timing gets off, and all of a sudden you're gone. So I don't like that idea, because I don't think that's a benefit for the team that has a bye. I think it actually hurts them. The other thing that I'm not fond of is picking your opponent. I mean, you know, I think that's stupid. You know, that's too gimmicky for me. You know, figure out a way, and then, you know, the top seeds get to play the games at home, but you don't get to pick your opponent. You just line it up like you do in every other sport. You know what I mean? It's just too much of a gimmick, I think, to do it like that. You know, if you're the last seed, you play the two seed, you know, just like any other sport does. You know, the picking your opponent thing, I don't like at all.
Well, and the fact that, you know, you always talk about bulletin board material, and, you know, if you televise something like that, that's one of the arguments that the owners or some of the team management have been saying is, you know, that's bulletin board material. Hey, my wildcard team was the one team that was not picked. No one wants to play us because that means they're scared of us. You can, you know, use that to build up your team and push them forward. Or, hey, you know, we got bypassed, right, or we got picked because they think they can beat us. Well, let's go out there and show them what we're made of. So, I mean, I get it. I mean, it does build intrigue. It does put some strategy into it. But yeah, I mean, especially if you're going to televise it, it really almost sets up for the higher seeds to kind of be at a disadvantage versus, you know, picking a team and going, okay, now I'll be perfectly honest. I think if you go this route, I don't see a whole lot of teams deviating from that normal structure. I think you're going to have, you know, a one-off here and there. I mean, maybe if Tony La Russa is coaching a team, he may maybe make a change. But I think for the most part, if you give teams the option to pick, they're not really going to deviate too far from the seedings per se, because they know what the plan is. They know that they are the higher seed. They won more games. They feel like they can beat anybody that they play. So why piss somebody off by not picking them? Just go with the standard structure that you have and go from there. I mean, I get the intrigue behind it, but I think I'm along the lines with you. Yeah, higher seed teams get all the home games. That makes sense. Gives them an incentive to get one of those higher seeds. But leave the picking of teams and stuff like that out of the way. Just straight through 2 versus 6, 3-5, or what have you, 2-7, however it plays out. That's what the way it should be in my mind. Just keep the picking stuff out of it.
Yep, I totally agree.
Also in the news with baseball, Marcell Ozuna. Basically, MLB came out with their suspension of Marcell Ozuna today. It's basically a retroactive suspension of 20 games for violating the domestic abuse policy. Going to forfeit $1.55 million in salary. It seems like maybe he might be on the track and the path to righting that wrong and maybe just moving on. He went through a diversionary program as well and has to kind of go through some more steps in order to get it dropped. Now, the felony charge was dropped earlier this year. And really what it comes down to is, you know, we saw Ozuna here in St. Louis. We know what kind of person he is and the excitement that he has for the love of the game. But you really just hope in this instance that, you know, this has been a wake-up call for him, that he can, you know, really repair the relationship that he has affected. And really, as far as the victim is concerned in this, is that they're able to be able to move on and leave, you know, lead a healthy life as well. And for Ozuna himself to be able to grow and lead a healthier life as well for those around him as well. So the suspension, retroactive to last year, he should be able to start the season fresh this year. But really, when it comes down to it, the human piece of it is you hope that both sides, both parties, have been able to move on and are now living healthier lives.
Yeah, and you know, he missed the whole season, and as a baseball player, and he should have been punished. But you know, I'm sure baseball is looking at it going, "See, you got your punishment. You missed your chance to play and win a World Series, because he would have been a World Series champion in Atlanta." So, I mean, I can understand them saying, okay, there's that, you know, we'll move on now. You've done everything you had to do. The charges were dropped. Felony charges were dropped. You know, and you know, it was his wife that he assaulted, I believe. And I think she tried to drop the charges pretty much right after she filed him, if I remember correctly, and they wouldn't let her. So, yeah, I mean, I think they've reconciled, and I think, you know, they've done whatever. So hopefully, like you said, he's learned and they can move on and they've got kids, and hopefully the family can repair that relationship and, you know, Marcell can be a happy, productive, peaceful member of society going forward.
Yep, that's definitely all you can hope for, and be a banner person for how to not do something and be a better person for it. So, all right, let's move on to the NFL because it was Thanksgiving, and you always know those Thanksgiving games are going to be absolutely crazy. And really the rest of the weekend was a little odd as well. And we won't get into too much how we did in picks because we both did not do so well in our picks in pretty much all the games. I mean, we had a couple here and there, but outside of that, we were pretty terrible this week. Let's first talk about the Thursday games because they were outside of the Buffalo New Orleans games. The other two, the Chicago Detroit game, the Vegas Dallas game. I wouldn't say they were classics in a sense. You know, the Bears end up beating Detroit on the last second field goal. Raiders take out the Cowboys in overtime, the beneficiary of a bunch of penalties. I mean, I think that's probably the most penalized game I think I've ever watched anywhere. High school, college, NFL, that was just absolutely insane. You know, the Cowboys just could not for the life of them not draw a penalty. I mean, Anthony Brown, 4 pass interference penalties, basically kept Vegas in that game. But you know, what did you see in those games on Thursday that made you kind of go, huh? And I know what you're going to say about Dallas, but we'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, the Lions-Bears game, it just proves those teams are both bad. You know, I mean, I had the Lions. If not for that Bears field goal, I would have gotten all 3 games on Thanksgiving, right? Because I actually thought the Lions would win that game. You know, Andy Dalton played pretty well for the Bears. I think he threw for 300 yards. But, you know, the Bears just couldn't get much of anything going offensively. Detroit's a train wreck. You know, I mean, they were in that game, but, you know, basically because, like I said, the Bears are awful. I thought that was the Lions game that they were going to win. I'm not sure Detroit wins a game now since they couldn't pull that one out. So, you know, they may go 0-17, which, you know, would make them the first team and only team in NFL history to be 0-17.
Well, they do have a tie, though.
Oh, that's right. You're right. So they would be 0-16. So they would tie themselves as the only team to go 0-16 twice and have done it within in like a 5-year span. So that'll be fun. You know, and Chicago is just bad. You know, there's not much talent on that Bears team. You know, I don't know what you'd do with Justin Fields. I know he's shown some signs of improvement this year, but Andy Dalton gives them a chance to win. And as bad as the Bears are, we talk about the NFC, they're only a game out of the last playoff spot. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe you let Dalton play and see if he can get you in the playoffs and have Justin Fields kind of grow and keep him upright and healthy and see if you can have him ready for next year. But yeah, the NFC is just a mess. And then you talk about the Cowboys-Raiders game, you know, and it's funny. People are like, oh, man, the Cowboys had so many penalties. You know, both of those, they had the same amount of penalties. Both teams had 15 penalties called on them. That was the worst referee job I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it was like the refs went, hey, we're on national television on Thanksgiving. I'm pretty sure Angel Hernandez borrowed somebody's ref jersey and ran out there and decided to be an NFL ref that day. Yeah, just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, some of the calls were those 4 pass interference penalties were all 4 pass interference penalties. You know, he wasn't playing the ball. He was didn't turn his head around. He was running into the receivers. So those penalties were. But I think there were like 4 special teams plays in a row where they called a block in the back. Well, you can call a block on a back in every single play in a football game if you want to. I mean, you can find a way to call that. It was just awful. And, you know, the Raiders took advantage of it. Dallas did not. You know, Greg Zuerlein missed a field goal. Was a shocker there. Greg the Leg not always real accurate as a kicker, even though he can kick the ball a mile. And then it comes back to, again, when the big moment comes up, Dak Prescott can't make the play. You know, he had a 3rd down, could have kept the drive going. Dallas could have won that game. Can't make a throw. Throws the ball into the ground. You know, I've said it for 4 years now. The guy puts up big numbers. He does, you know, and he can ooh and ah you because he'll throw for 350, 400 yards. But when the games, when it comes down to that key, crucial moment in a game, he is not going to make the play. He just has shown that time and time again that he can't do it. And they're not going to win with him as their quarterback. I'm sure I've offended a bunch of people who think Dak Prescott's wonderful. But at some point, you have to look at it and go, you know, I'm not sure they're ever going to get over the hump with him, although And, you know, same thing with Zeke. You know, Zeke has a good game, then he has a bad game, then he's hurt. You know, they just have not shown the ability to really step up in big moments. And, you know, everybody was all excited about the Cowboys. Ooh, the Cowboys are 7-1. Then they started playing some people, and now they've lost 3 out of 4, and they're 7-4. And, you know, the Washington football team and the Eagles are nipping at their heels for the NFC East. And they're going to screw around and be in danger of making the playoffs. You know, that's just what's going to happen. And so, you know, that's Dallas for you. I mean, it's what we've seen for the last 20 years. They don't play discipline. They just go out there and Jerry says, "Ooh, go out there and win some football. I don't know. Make me some money. Then we'll steal a team out of St. Louis and it'll all be wonderful." But yeah, so, you know, that's the Cowboys. And then, like you said, Buffalo came out and kind of righted the ship and played like the Bills that you expect them to be as they beat up on the Saints. And they're going to have to do that the next couple of weeks if they want to win the AFC East, because unfortunately it looks like the Patriots are for real.
Oh, I think they 100% are for real. And Mac Jones has done wonders there in that position. You have to give credit to Bill Belichick for what he's done. You know, we really spent the last year and a half trying to figure out, you know, who is better for who, Belichick for Brady or Brady for Belichick. And I mean, I think most people have started to come to the realization that they were both really good for each other. And now they're on their own doing their thing and they are still successful. So that's the thing you have to look at is, you know, it wasn't one or the other that propped each other up. They worked tandemly, hand in hand. They did what, you know, Belichick did what did with Brady what he could do, and Brady did with Belichick what he could do, and they won a lot. And now they're still implying those trades and new teams, and they're being successful. I mean, they found a Brady clone essentially, and Mac Jones up in New England, and they're doing everything with they're doing it again with no name receivers, no name running backs, a solid defense, nothing spectacular, but team effort. And you look at what Brady's doing down in, you know, in Tampa, he's got his safety blankets and he's staying upright. If you're Tom Brady, if you aren't getting pressured in the pocket, you're going to be able to win games every single week. And, you know, both teams are playing to their strengths, and it's no wonder that both of those teams are at the top of their divisions right now. And, you know, you look at the teams in the AFC and the NFC at who's up top. And I mean, I'm sitting there going, I don't think I'm surprised now at who's up there. I mean, yeah, you talk about the NFC East and Dallas, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, you look at the North, it's Green Bay. And whatever you think about Aaron Rodgers as a human being, as a quarterback, he just keeps on doing what he's doing. And he's got his guys there. I wouldn't say that you have necessarily a ton of superstars. Obviously, Devontae Adams is there. And Aaron Jones is really proving to be a solid back. He came back this week. But outside of that, I mean, Randall Cobb is, you know, on the downside of his career. You don't have, you know, superior tight ends. Your defense is still kind of eh. But I think Green Bay is exactly where we expected Green Bay to be. And then over in the you know, the South, it's Tampa. We've already talked about them. And in the West, Arizona, even on a bye week, they seem to win. With the Rams losing to Green Bay, they get healthy with Hopkins and Kyler Murray getting another chance of having a week off to recover and coming off of a big win last week for the Cardinals. I mean, you look at the two teams on byes this week, Arizona and Kansas City, I think both of them won despite not even playing this week.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you talk about Arizona. I think Arizona is probably the best team in the NFC right now. You know, because like you said, they've won 2 out of the last 3 weeks without DeAndre Hopkins and without Kyler Murray, and they keep finding a way to win. And how funny is it that Arizona can win with their backup quarterback and, you know, a banged up AJ Green still playing and a banged up Zach Ertz, and they still find a way to keep their offense going. And then you go a little bit to the west to LA, and the Rams go out and get Von Miller, and they go out and they get Odell Beckham. And guess what? They haven't won since they brought either one of those guys in. Weird. You know, Matthew Stafford is playing like Matthew Stafford. I mean, he has good games, but he makes mistakes. You know, there's a reason Matthew Stafford has never won anything. You know, he's good, but he will find a way to make a mistake or throw a bad ball here or there. And, you know, that defense is not very good. You know, you've got two studs in Jalen Ramsey and Aaron Donald. You know, Von Miller passed his prime, and other than that, there's not much on that defense. And then their offense, they don't really have a running game. You know, Stafford's Stafford's pretty good for the most part. Cooper Kupp had a great he's been banged up. You know, Cooper Kupp is their star wide receiver, although, you know, Cooper Kupp is a glorified Danny Amendola in a lot of ways. I mean, they're the same type wide receiver. And then you have Beckham, who did catch a touchdown this week and may do something, but we'll see. But I just don't think that they've got a bunch of names there, but I'm not sure that they're going to make the playoffs. They're on the verge of not making the playoffs, which would not break my heart by any means.
Yeah, because you got the 49ers kind of charging up there as well in that NFC West. So not totally out of the question, but on the verge of the Rams, you know, leaking out of the playoff picture. And, oh, my gosh, that would be the second loss of the year. Big one for the Rams. That's crazy. I mean, the best thing in the world would be for the Rams to end up, well, I mean, they can't, but 7-9 again and, 7-9, $790 million loss. I mean, that's, you know, that would be just an epic, perfect way for this season to end for the Rams. A couple of the losers that I kind of picked out this week, mainly over in the AFC, because AFC is tightly contested. There's a lot of potential as far as teams are concerned about getting into the playoffs, but a couple of teams that really hurt their chances this past week. You got to look at Indianapolis. I mean, they played a tough Tampa team. Don't get me wrong. I think, you know, that was a really, really well-played game. They only lost by 7, but for a team that absolutely dominated on the run last week to be completely stymied by the Bucs and, you know, kind of go away from it early and then try to force it late, it was a little surprising. And the fact that the Titans lost to the Patriots, the Colts had a chance to really put some pressure on Tennessee. They definitely were a loser. I mean, they got a tough stretch coming up after their bye week. They got to play New England, Arizona, and Vegas. And that right there, that stretch could essentially make or break their playoff push. I mean, what do you think about the Colts? Do they have a chance at making the playoffs, or was this kind of the moment where they had to win or that was it?
I think the saving grace for the Colts is the fact that Tennessee is so completely banged up. You know, your running back and Derrick Henry and your best wide receiver are both now on IR in Tennessee. So, I mean, that's definitely left the door open for the Colts. Only one of those two teams is getting in, but it definitely gives Indianapolis still some hope that, because I'm just not sure that Tennessee is going to be able to do enough with those guys banged up that they're really able to sustain it and really make a deep run.
And then Cleveland, I know this is kind of one of your teams. They had a real chance of really staying in the AFC North race, cutting into that Ravens division lead. They intercepted Lamar Jackson 4 times last night and just could not capitalize. Their running game has completely gone away. Now, I know Hunt and Chubb have both dealt with COVID and all the stuff that goes around it. So can't necessarily 100% blame the disappearance of a running game on them because they've been out for the most part. But Baker looks scared. Their defense, while good, is still the only thing that's positive for them this year. Obviously, they lost, you know, Beckham Jr. They haven't really been able to get anything going this year, and that's surprising considering the talent they have on that team.
Well, you got to remember that Baker's got a torn labrum in his shoulder, and he's got a torn tendon in his heel, so he can't really run and he can't really throw. And he's still going out there and trying to help them win. And then, like you said, you've had Nick Chubb hurt, and he's had COVID. Kareem Hunt's been hurt. Jarvis Landry's been hurt a couple of times. I mean, they've just had so many injuries, especially on the offensive side of the ball, that, you know, it's just caught up with them. I don't think they're going to be able to overcome it because, you know, Baker's not going to magically get better this year just because of the fact that he's so banged up. You know, until he gets that shoulder fixed, he's going to have issues. And so, you know, I think you have to look at it and say it's just kind of a lost year in Cleveland.
So at what point do you, you know, end Baker's season and say, hey, get the rest, get the surgery, fix yourself up, be ready to go for next year? Because, I mean, yeah, they're sitting at 6-6. I'm not saying they're not out of it because, I mean, over in the NFC, you got the 4-7 Bears still a game back at the playoffs. It's not like the Browns are out of it completely. But at some point, you have to look at it and you got to go, okay, like you said, it's a lost season. Let's see what we got and maybe some of these backups. Get Baker healthy and ready to go for next year. And just kind of essentially throw in the towel. What point do you do that?
You know, they're probably not going to do it for another week or two. You know, another loss or two, they will, because then they're out of it. And then, you know, there's not a real point in playing him. But as long as they're in contention, I think he's going to force himself to go out there.
I mean, that's kind of at the detriment of that team, though. I mean, if he can't go out there and throw the ball or something like that, you know, at what point do you sit there and say, look, you are a detriment to the team and the potential for us to win? I mean, I'm not sitting there saying their backup is all that great, but if he can at least throw a ball, don't you think you have to maybe make that decision?
Well, I think you just answered your own question there. It tells me that the coaches have absolutely no faith that he can go out there and do anything to help them win a game. So, yeah, I think it's just a bad situation right now. And, you know, like you said, Cleveland's probably going to miss the playoffs, which is disappointing because there are pretty high expectations this year. But we'll see what happens. There's still five games. Maybe Chubb and Hunt get healthy. Maybe Jarvis Landry is able to do something. We'll just have to see. But right now, it does not look good for their chances.
No, it doesn't, because you got the Bengals coming out their bye week, you know, having a blowout win for them. You've got the Ravens, who, despite missing their top two running backs and receivers left and right, and Lamar throwing four picks, still winning the division. It's definitely probably the toughest division in the NFL is that AFC North, despite, you know, some of the injuries that these teams have suffered. It's definitely a great division for sure. Moving over to college football, we talked about at the top of the show, lots of coaching moves have already gone down, with obviously more so in the works. This past weekend, you saw Lincoln Riley get hired by USC away from Oklahoma. Just a day after he said he was not going to LSU, he takes the USC job, which, you know, in my mind, it makes a little sense. You know, Oklahoma was going to the SEC, LSU already in the SEC. It just tells me that Lincoln Riley wanted a shot at getting into a championship game and a championship playoff by going to USC versus trying to fight his way up in the SEC. He goes there. Bob Stoops is going to coach the Sooners in their bowl game. So, you know, bringing back the legend and Bob Stoops to do that. But, you know, you look at first at what Lincoln Riley going to USC means, and then you have to look at what is possible for Oklahoma when it comes to coaches coming in and what that does for the players, because it comes out today that Spencer Rattler is going to leave Oklahoma. He was benched in favor of Caleb Williams this year. He's got 3 years of eligibility left. So, I mean, Oklahoma is kind of on a teeter-totter at the moment, getting ready to join the SEC. They're going to have to make a splash when it comes to a coaching hire, are they not?
Yeah, they're going to have to go out and do something. You know, a name that's definitely made the rounds in the last day or so is Mark Stoops. Like you talked about, Bob Stoops coming out of retirement to coach them. His brother, the head coach at Kentucky, who's turned that team around, may be in contention for that Oklahoma job. That would be interesting to see if that happened, because we know, much like Bob, Mark's kind of forte is defense and making those teams really, really tough and big and physical is kind of what he did in Kentucky that helped turn that around. So could he come to Oklahoma and kind of fix their defense? Because that's been the Sooners' problem the last two or three years, is that, you know, they've been able to score points, but that rough, tough Sooner defense that most of us grew up watching has not been there. So maybe Stoops is the answer there. Spencer Rattler go to USC. Does he follow Lincoln Riley out there, you think? Can you hear me? Did I lose you?
I can hear you.
Okay. Were you able to hear that question? Do you think Spencer Rattler goes to USC?
No, I don't think he does. I think he, you know, he's an Arizona kid. There's four teams that have kind of come out there as potential fits for Rattler. And honestly, the reason I don't see him going to USC is because he's been benched the last two seasons under Lincoln Riley. And it's because of poor performances against Texas. Yeah, he came back in that first year off the bench and beat Texas. But I don't think, you know, Riley has any confidence in a guy like Spencer Rattler. You know, he's looked at, you know, maybe Ole Miss is a place that he could go. You know, Lane Kiffin has been a guy that's been rumored to be the replacement in Oklahoma as well. Would Spencer Rattler going to Ole Miss keep Lane Kiffin there? You've got South Carolina. Shane Beamer has familiarity with Rattler as well. He was there for 2 years with Rattler. SMU is another one. But the one for me that would be intriguing for sure is Arizona. I mean, he's from Arizona. The program needs a bit of a face and a bit of a renaissance. So if it's about making a name for himself and trying to lead a program back to prominence, it would be Arizona. But if he wants to keep the big prominence alive. I think he has to go to Ole Miss, I think, and stay in the SEC and really make a name for himself in that, in the biggest conference in college football for me.
Yeah, although if you're Spencer Rattler and you're going to transfer out of Oklahoma, I mean, if you're going to go to an SEC school, to go to Ole Miss doesn't – you'd be better off, I think, to stay in Oklahoma, honestly. I mean, your chances of winning in the SEC would be better with an Oklahoma team than an Ole Miss. At least that's the way I look at it.
Oh, no, I mean, I get it. I get it for sure, but – you know, without knowing who's going to come in there. Now Cliff Kingsbury is a guy that they say Oklahoma's targeting. I don't know why he would leave Arizona right now with the success he's having there. I don't know what you could possibly offer to get him to leave there, but you know, his offense makes sense for a Spencer Rattler. But the fact that Rattler already entered the transfer portal without even waiting to see who the new coach is, I think that speaks volumes to, you know, what that not franchise, but what that university means to him and really what he's looking for. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense for him to stay at Oklahoma if he wants to be a big-time SEC player. But I think maybe it's just a matter of he wants to go play for a coach that he feels like is going to, fit him into the system. And I could see Lane Kiffin being the guy that does it. Now, another college that's been floated out there is Oregon. Oregon might be a place that he could go to as well, and that's a place that he could go in and potentially fight for a national title because it's the Pac-12 and Oregon's going to be there year in right. and year out. I mean, I don't know, would Oregon be a fit for him as well?
I mean, his offensive skill set would fit with what Oregon has done over the years, so that would be an interesting move. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how the Pac-12 plays out now, because when you move Lincoln Riley to USC, how quickly is he able to bring that program back to prominence? Because, you know, it's kind of been Oregon or nothing in the Pac-12 the last few years. So we'll see how that all plays out as well. And then the other big one that was really shocking was the move that you told me right before we came on the show, that Notre Dame's losing their longtime coach.
Yeah, Brian Kelly moving to LSU from Notre Dame. That opens up, the Notre Dame position as well. And it makes you wonder who's going to replace that. I don't know if you follow Annie Agar on Twitter or anything like that. She's been very prominent there with college and in the NFL. And basically she tweeted out earlier today, this would be the Notre Dame job would be the second thing that would fall into Urban Meyer's lap this year. Could you see Urban Meyer leaving Jacksonville to go coach at Notre Dame?
I don't think that would happen. I don't think Notre Dame is built on prestige and honor and, you know, doing things the right way. I don't think Urban Meyer and the way he coaches or the way he's done things in programs, I don't think that would work at Notre Dame. I think Notre Dame has themselves on a higher pedestal as far as, you know, they're more concerned. Again, they're more concerned about education and image. I mean, they want to be a successful program, but it's more about old school history and the prestige and the honor and the legacy of Notre Dame as much as anything. So I don't think Urban Meyer would be a good fit there at all.
So basically what you're saying is Dabo Swinney is going to be the next head coach of the Fighting Irish.
No, I don't see that happening either. I don't think Dabo's going anywhere.
Well, because Clemson won't let him go, or because Notre Dame doesn't want to bring him in.
I don't think Clemson lets him go. I mean, I don't know why Dabo would want to leave there. He's got pretty much full run of the school, so I don't see Dabo leaving there. It'll be interesting to see where Notre Dame goes. I was trying to think if there was an alum that was a really good coaching prospect that could go there. Man, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where they go with that coaching hire. I'm sure a lot of people at Notre Dame are surprised, although, you know, yeah, it'll be interesting because I'm sure I'd like to talk to some Notre Dame people, because I'm sure there's a lot of people really shocked that Brian Kelly's leaving, although he wasn't totally loved during his tenure at Notre Dame either.
No, he was not, and everything that I've been reading so far in the last hour and a half or so is that it was completely out of the blue, and Brian Kelly's essentially ghosted everybody in the Notre Dame organization. There was a tweet that went out about a assistant coach out on a recruiting mission. And he said he walked out of the house of a recruit that he was just at and saw the news and goes, wow, I just got made to look like an asshole, essentially, because he was in there, you know, pitching Notre Dame with Brian Kelly at the helm. And literally he walks out and Brian Kelly is no longer the head coach of Notre Dame. So, I mean, that's the thing that gets me about this whole college football thing is the fact that, you know, you're punishing players for wanting to transfer, but a coach can leave at the drop of a dime and essentially get paid to do it. And not only get paid to leave a program, but paid to go coach one at the same time. So not only are you know, yeah, maybe the penalty for some is a minor $1 million for a guy that maybe gets $100 million, but you know, that's just the confusing hierarchy and the confusing piece of the NCAA is that, you know, college football coaches and maybe some college basketball coaches are the highest paid government employees in some states. And yet if a kid wants to move to another school for more playing time, or maybe he just wants to follow the coach that left and goes to coach somewhere else, yet they are the ones that are going to have to sit because they want to follow and the competitive advantage for a team may improve because this player is leaving or coming into a program. Like where is that? I mean, is that ever going to change? I mean, how does this even rectify itself in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's starting to a little bit. You know, they are making exemptions where guys don't have to sit. And they're talking about totally changing that completely, which they need to. Like you said, if a coach leaves a program, then a player should be able to leave a program. You know, especially, you know, the guy recruited him. That's one of the reasons he went there. And then he looks around and goes, hey, wait a minute. I don't know these coaches. I don't know. This isn't why I came here. I want out. They should be able to leave just as easily. So, yeah, I think we'll get to a point. You know, that's a slippery slope too, because then all of a sudden, and we're starting to see that in basketball with the transfer portal and all these, look at the Mizzou basketball team. You know, pretty much every kid on that team last year left and the whole new team transferred in. So, you know, that can go too far that way too. So you've got to find a happy medium there too, so that kids aren't just bouncing around because somebody made them mad. They're like, oh, hey, I don't like this anymore. Now I'm going here, and, you know, and then they're there for 6 months. And they're like, oh, I don't like this. I'm going there. You know, so, you know, it's hard to say exactly how you make that work to where it's fair for everybody.
Yeah, it really is. And just speaking of the transfer portal, Mizzou football losing four guys to the transfer portal today. Daniel Parker Jr., Chris Sheeran, Messiah Swinson, and Ish Burden are all transferring out. Although they did just get a commit the other day, 2023 commit from tight end Brett Norfleet from Francis Howell, 12th best tight end nationally, 7th best player in Missouri, 222nd best in the country. So Coach Drink is still really working that recruiting trail, not just for next year, but for the next couple of years and continuing to bring in high-quality players for his program. Next year is going to be a huge year for Coach Drink and the Mizzou football program, and we'll talk about that as it gets closer to, you know, the next season. They still got a bowl game to go to, so we'll see how that plays out as the bowl games are announced here in the near future. Before we get out of here tonight, just a quick hit on the Blues. They're going to be hosting Tampa Bay tomorrow night. The Blues coming off a 6-3 victory over Columbus on Saturday. Three straight wins at home for the Blues. Dealing with a ton of injuries, though. David Perron still out with that upper body injury. No timetable for his return, although he was back at practice today doing some light workout stuff. But as we know with Perron, concussion issues in the past, that doesn't mean much when it comes to his potential return. You just hope that it's not very long that he's able to bounce back and get out there very, very quickly. Klim Kostin, James Neal go on the IR. Blues recalled Dakota Joshua for the game against Columbus, and now Logan Brown gets the call up as well and will be inserted into the lineup tomorrow against the Lightning. Marco Scandella may be a healthy scratch tomorrow night. Now, he and Colton Pareko have been the two whipping boys on the defensive end of things so far this year. So maybe just another one of those reset kind of moments where, hey, I got to get up in the press box and see what I'm missing. Maybe to get himself back into the style that he was when he came over here from Minnesota a couple of years ago. So we'll see how that plays out. That means, you know, Nico Mikola is going to get back in there. Scotty Perunovic has been playing very, very well as well. So going to be a very interesting game as the Blues get ready to face the Florida teams over the next four games. So they're going to have Tampa Bay and Florida twice in the next week or so. So definitely a big time game there going against the reigning Stanley Cup champions and St. Louis's own Pat Maroon. So that should be a fun game for sure. I mean, the Blues are still kind of an enigma right now.
Yeah. Yeah, they are up and down. You're not sure what team you're going to get from night to night. But like you said, they've had a lot of injuries, a lot of changes, a lot of moving parts. So still, I mean, it's not really early anymore, but you still got lots of season to try to figure out exactly where you're at. So I still have faith in this team to be a playoff team. You know, we'll just have to see where we go. I do want to ask you a question, though. What do you think is the issue with Colton Parayko at this point? You know, he was supposed to be the next big defensive stud. You know, last year he had the back issues, supposedly completely healthy this year, and he's just not the same guy.
Honestly, and I don't think this is a bad thing, but I think it's something that he needs to figure out. Is I think he really tried to take too much from what Alex Pietrangelo did. You know, Parayko's trying to be too much of a finesse player, too much of a guy that's not playing to his strengths per se. He's not using his body. He's not putting the big heavy shot on net all the time. I think he's trying to be Alex Pietrangelo when he's not. He needs to use what he's been given and use it effectively. And that's something that the coaching staff is going to have to really continue to impart in his mind is, look, you need to use your size. You need to use your physicality. You need to use your shot, because those are the three things that are going to make you an elite defenseman in this league. And the Blues just don't have a lot of physical defensemen. I mean, Justin Falk is probably, outside of Bortuzzo, Falk is probably the next physical defenseman on this team. And he's a smaller defender. And he's not going to go out there and lay huge hits out, but he lays out smart hits and he uses his body effectively. So if Parayko is going to improve, he needs to start building on the blocks that Justin Falk has shown. But then also, and I don't know why this has not happened yet. Maybe it's because of what Chris Pronger doesn't want to do at this point. But you need to get Chris Pronger in Pareko's ear. And you need to be like, look, you need to get physical. You need to put a chip on your shoulder. You need to have a bit of an edge. And you need to go out there and play that way. And if Chris Pronger hasn't been utilized in that instance, the Blues – damn well better get him on the ice and in Colton Parayko's ear saying, look, you use that body to your advantage. And if you don't, you're not going to be much longer in this league, because he's coming up on a contract extension. And if he wants to get max money and he wants to be secure in his financials for the rest of his career, he needs to figure it out. And that's totally 100% Colton Parayko as a player, because everything that he's doing outside of that, the community involvement, the media involvement, all of that stuff, perfect. He's awesome. He's a great guy, a great human being. I mean, obviously he's Layla's best friend and everything he's doing for underprivileged kids and all that stuff. Hands down, kudos. Could not thank him enough for what he's doing. But on the ice, if you want to be able to continue that off the ice stuff, you got to start getting a little bit more hardened and have that chip on your shoulder, or it's not going to matter what you do off the ice, because you're going to be, you know, off the ice a lot more than on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully he can get that straightened up, because, you know, the Blues are definitely a better team if Colton Parayko is playing well and is the force that they hope that he would be and could be. So hopefully that happens. So before we wrap it up, got one more question for you. We're going to go back to baseball real quick. Okay. So we know the deadline's coming on Wednesday. Do the Cardinals make another move before the deadline? And if so, who?
Oh, man. I think, yes, they do make another move, but I think it's going to be a bit more of the letdown variety. Not in the sense that it's a bad move, but I think it's going to be they're going to sign at least one, if not two, of the relievers that they're going after. And it's not going to be the sexy reliever picks. It's going to be a Luis Garcia. It's going to possibly be a Joe Kelly. I think if they do anything, it's going to be that. I'd like to be wrong. 100% would like to be wrong, but I think that's going to be what goes down, because – as we know with the Cardinals, they don't go as hard as they probably could on some of these guys. And that, you know, they're going to hide behind the fact that they went that extra year on Mats and say, hey, look, we did something that no other team was going to do. So you should be happy with that. And now we're going to find some pieces. So I think it's yes, that they're going to do something, but it's not going to be what you expect.
See, no, I don't think even if they don't sign like another big name before Wednesday, I don't think that means they won't. You know, I still think they're going to get a big piece, whether it's, you know, is it going to be Trevor Story? Who knows? You know, it might be a Kyle Schwarber. It might be one of those guys, but I still think they're going to get a big bat somewhere. Mo talked about that today again, that they definitely wanted to add another bat to this team as well as pitching. I think you're right. And I think a lot of Cardinal fans will be really excited if they do get Joe Kelly, because if you put Joe Kelly in that bullpen with Reyes and and Hicks and Gallegos and all those guys. I mean, Joe Kelly is a dominant back end of the bullpen type guy, you know, with closer experience. You know, I think that's a huge piece. If you can get Garcia and Kelly, I think that really shores up your bullpen. And I think this team is really, really, your bullpen will be a huge strength.
I think you're 100% right. So we'll see how it plays out. We should be back with you guys on Wednesday to discuss what went down in that time frame and what the Cardinals did or didn't do, as well as how the Blues fared. And maybe we got some more college football news. Who knows? Maybe Notre Dame will hire a coach by then. So we'll see how that plays out. Great to be back. Lots of action today, and hopefully more so to come here in the next couple of weeks as we get more college basketball stuff going, NFL playoff races, the NBA is in action, as well as the NHL. So lots of stuff to talk about. I want to thank you guys for listening tonight. I want to thank Scott, and I'm Wags, and we thank you guys once again for listening. Hope you guys have a great night, good start to your week, and thank you guys once again for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday for another edition of the Toasted Tavern.
Hey, it's you, man, here from Casey. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.